the plane and he started singing. And all of a sudden, there was this voice singing with him, and he's going, "There's nobody in the plane. Who is that?" And it was just, he said, it was just a thrill. He said it was just amazing. And I thought, that is so cool, because I've soloed and I've flown a plane, and there is something very special about being up there in the air all by yourself, close to God. And he had that cool experience. In the book Education, page 305, it says, "Though the rulers of this world know it not, yet often in their councils, angels have been spokesmen. Human eyes have looked upon them. Human ears have listened to their appeals. In the council hall and the court of justice, heavenly messengers have pleaded the cause of the persecuted and oppressed. They have defeated purposes and arrested evils and would have brought wrong and suffering to God's children. To the students in the heavenly school, all this will be unfolded. Every redeemed one will understand the ministry of angels in his own life. The angel who was his guardian from his earliest moment, the angel who watched his steps and covered his head in the day of peril, the angel who was with him in the valley of the shadow of death, who marked his resting place, who was the first to greet him in the resurrection morning. What will it be to hold converse with him and to learn the history of divine intervention in the individual life of heavenly cooperation in every work for humanity? All the perplexities of life's experience will then be made plain. Where to us have appeared only confusion and disappointment, broken purposes and thwarted plans will be seen a grand overruling, victorious purpose, a divine harmony." The first story I'm going to share with you today is called Badge-Bearing Angel. Joshua Jones was trying desperately to stay awake. He had been the keynote speaker at Arizona, and now at 11:30 p.m. was driving to remove the remote stretches of Interstate 17 back at Phoenix. It was very warm, and his car's air conditioning had stopped working earlier in the week. The warm air and solitary highway was causing Joshua to nod off occasionally, and he was finding it nearly impossible to concentrate on his driving. "Come on, Lord," he prayed aloud, his voice urgent, "keep me awake just until the next stop." Less than a minute later, Joshua saw flashing lights in his rearview mirror. There had been almost no traffic on the interstate for miles, and the area he was traveling was utterly remote. Joshua, who had been driving barefoot, struggled to put his shoes on as he pulled his car over, briefly wondering what a police officer was doing in this area. One thing was certain, he was definitely wide awake now that an officer was pulling him over. He stopped his car on the shoulder of the road, his shoes now on his feet, and watched in his mirror as the officer approached the car. He wore a standard highway patrol uniform, but he was smiling. Joshua had only received two tickets in his life, and none of them from smiling officers. "Good evening, officer," Joshua said, as the patrolman stopped beside the open window. "Are you all right?" he asked, bending over a bit and looking at Joshua with searching eyes. Joshua noted his badge number 37. "Yes, fine," the officer laughed. "At least you have your shoes on now." Joshua looked puzzled. How had the officer known about his shoes? Before he could voice the question, the officer spoke again. "You've been driving a long way, and it's late. You almost fell asleep out there, didn't you?" "Why, yes," Joshua stammered. "I was really struggling to stay awake. Maybe you can tell me where the nearest rest stop is." "Better yet, I'll take you there," the officer said. "You spent the weekend helping everyone else. Now it's your turn to get a little assistance. Follow me." The officer turned to leave. "Wait," Joshua cried, "aren't you giving me a ticket or something?" The officer looked at him evenly and shook his head. "No ticket. Just wanted to make sure you were all right. That's my job, you know." Joshua nodded, distracted by the officer's strange comments. How had the patrolman know about the length of his trip or that he'd been helping people at the retreat? Joshua continued to consider the possibilities as he followed the officer back onto the highway and several miles south toward Phoenix. As he drove, he was pleased to realize he was no longer nodding off. The adrenaline burst from being approached by an officer had been enough to keep him awake for some time. Finally, the officer signaled that he was getting off at the next exit. As they approached the off-ramp, the officer exited first, taking a quick turn at the base of the hilly exit. As Joshua followed him, taking the same turn, he suddenly lost track of the motorcycle. He stopped his car and looked around. Directly ahead of him was a parking lot and a rest area, complete with a gas station and all-night restaurant. The setup was perfect. Joshua could stop for an hour or so, have some coffee, and maybe a conversation with the officer, and be on his way without fear of falling asleep. He looked around, waiting for some sign of the patrolman. When he still couldn't see the officer, Joshua figured he was probably parking his motorcycle somewhere near the restaurant. Joshua pulled into the parking lot, climbed out of his car, and waited. After 5 minutes, he walked around the perimeter of the rest area, intent on finding the officer who had guided him to safety. Finally, he had searched every possible spot. The patrolman had vanished. Years of work in Christian ministry, years of serving at his local church, had not prepared him for this feeling that swept over him at that moment. Suddenly, he understood. There was only one way the officer could have known about Joshua's weekend and his bare feet. The officer must have been an angel sent by God to protect him from falling asleep. And Joshua was certain he would have nodded off within minutes if it hadn't have been for the officer. There was still one way to find out. Remembering clearly the officer's badge number, Joshua headed toward the all-night diner and walked up to a payphone just outside the front door. He found the local highway patrol listed in the phone booth's yellow pages and dialed the number. "I need to know the name of an officer," he told the receptionist. "He helped me out a little while ago, and I want to thank him. Badge number?" 37, Joshua said, remembering vividly each number as he had seen it on the officer's badge. There was a pause. 37? Is that all? Yes. Are you sure? Yes, Joshua said, positive. Well, you must be thinking of something else, she said strangely. We don't have any officers with that badge number. Nothing even close. Our officers have numbers with 3 digits. It was true, Joshua told himself as he hung up the telephone. From that moment on, Joshua believed that the officer had been an angel sent to save him from certain death. If he had fallen asleep while driving the interstate. "Thank you, God," he said quietly, gazing toward the star-covered sky before climbing back into his car that night. "Thank you for protecting me." You know, God looks after us in so many different ways. I tried to find some diverse stories to share with you. This one's called Pennies from Heaven. I was at the bus stop heading home after a long, busy night waiting tables at a steakhouse when I realized I'd left my money pouch with $70 of tips in it. I couldn't afford to lose a night's pay. I ran back into the restaurant. There was no sign of my money. "Just imagine you had the night off," I told myself. I'd try to forget about it. The next night was even busier than the one before. I was already waiting on 5 tables at once when an elderly couple, both with snow-white hair, sat down in my section. No matter how hurried I was, I made sure to give them the best service I could. After their meal, I brought their check, thanked them for their patience, and rushed off to greet the next customers. The couple had left the table by this time. I picked up their check. "This isn't right," I thought. Counting the money they'd left for me, there was much more there than a $55 check. Way too much for a tip. I counted it out. $125. Quickly, I turned around to look for the couple they'd left the restaurant. I ran to the front door, but they weren't outside. Finally, I went to the hostess. "Did you see that elderly couple you sat in my section leave?" "What elderly couple?" the hostess said. "You were so busy, we didn't see anyone in your section until just now." When they had the very first camp meeting at the location that it's at now, I had an experience, and the more you think about it, the more you realize it had to be angels. And the angel stories that I read, there was this one theme. Most of the time, they didn't talk to the people. So that first year at camp meeting, it rained. I mean, it poured and dumped. And finally, we had a break on Sunday morning when we were eating breakfast. The rain had stopped. All of a sudden, the sky opened up and it started dumping again. So Ken and his dad and his brother went rushing to get the PA equipment under cover so that it wouldn't be ruined. His mom was grabbed my kids, and I ran back to camp to get stuff taken care of. I had a sister-in-law who was dancing out in the rain and prancing around and thinking it was great. So I was having a hard time not feeling a little bit bitter, and I prayed because Morris Vinden had been our speaker, and he was amazing, and it had been such an incredible week. And I went, Lord, we've had such a blessing. Help me not to feel resentful. And I went back to our camp, and there were two people in my camp folding all the clothes, our camping gear, and giving it to me. And I put it in our car, and I got to realizing our car was fairly new, and when I put it in there, it really wasn't that wet. And I said to them, what are you doing? Thank you. I really appreciate this, but don't you have your own camp you need to do? Didn't say a word. They just kept right on, got the car loaded, took it home, and it was just amazing because I'm really convinced it was an angel. Okay, this one appealed to me because it happened in Europe, in Switzerland. Finally, the storm clouds lifted. It had rained for nearly 2 weeks straight. Our European vacation better suited for ducks than my two youngest children and me. Still, we'd had a wonderful stay with my elderly cousin, Tante Helga. She lived there her whole life in Thummersbach, a tiny village of about 900 people, and knew the mountains like the back of her hand. A retired obstetrician, she was a friend to everyone in the community. Her villa, on the shore of a lake high up in the Austrian mountains, was like a scene from a storybook. It was magical. We'd been to cathedrals and museums, castles, outdoor markets, and beautiful gardens, every historical site for miles around. But what I really wanted to do was go hiking. We'd come all this way from our home, an hour outside of New York City, to walk the Alps. I wanted Mark 10 and Sandy 7 to see my birthplace in all its rugged, breathtaking, snow-capped glory, to run through alpine meadows and dip their feet in ice-cold stream. But in the mountains, storms can quickly turn deadly. No adventure was worth putting the kids in danger. So that morning, when the sun burst over the horizon, it was like a gift from God. Right after breakfast, my friend Wolfgang knocked on the door. Come on, what are we waiting for? He said. It's a perfect day to touch the sky. Really? Sandy said, her eyes wide with wonder. This was the moment, the magic I've been waiting for. We'll take the chairlift up, Wolfgang said, then have a picnic at the top and a leisurely hike back down. His wife and two children would come too. I could already see us dancing through a field of wildflowers, just like the Von Trapps. I can't wait to hear all about it, Tante Helga said. We hugged her goodbye and set off on our excursion. The chairlift swayed gently, carrying us over the treetops, higher and higher above the timberline. Look, I said to Sandy beside me. Below us, blue flowers and alpine laurel blossoms among the rocks. Above us, almost close enough to touch, with a powder blue sky, and in the distance, snow-capped peaks stood guard. Cool, said Sandy. I agreed. Near the summit, we feasted for a lunch of black bread, cheese, cold cuts, then drank our fill of clear, pure mountain spring water. The boys chased after the girls picked bouquets of wildflowers. Far below us, birds circled lazily over the valley. In a meadow, we spied some brown cows, their eyes large and gentle, their colorful bells serenading us as they grazed. No one seemed to be watching them, but I knew that the milk cows were often let loose on the high alpine pastures where they could eat their fill of meadow grasses. High on a hill, and it was a lonely goat herd, I sang out. The kids answered. I looked at Wolfgang to join in, but he was staring at the sky. A storm's coming, he said. We need to find the trail and head down. I glanced upward. Black clouds blotted out the sun. In the distance, we heard the rumble of thunder. Let's hurry, I said. We quickly reached the trailhead, Wolfgang in the lead, his long legs stretching farther with every step. Fat raindrops spattered on my arms. We reached the forest, hoping for safety, but under the canopy it was nearly as dark as night, broken only by jagged flashes of lightning above our heads. We could barely find our way. Wind lashed the treetops, branches bent and swayed madly. The rain fell in sheets, pelting us as we zigzagged down the switchback. My feet stumbled against rocks, yet there was no choice but to press on. Every minute we were outside increased the danger of a lightning strike. "I'm scared," Sandy cried. "My feet can't go that fast." "I'll carry you," Wolfgang shouted above the din. He lifted her, holding her tight against his waist. "But we need to go faster. The storm's getting worse. Our best chance is to go straight down to the road at the bottom. Follow me." With Sandy in his arms, he turned and crashed through the undergrowth. We scrambled after him. I struggled to keep my balance. Branches clawed at our arms and faces. My hair and clothes were drenched. Water streamed down my back. I felt helpless. A flash of lightning followed immediately by a deafening thunderclap exploding on the nearby trees made us realize that the storm was now directly overhead. And there's nothing like thunder in the Alps. It's a whole lot louder than what we have here. Trembling with fear, I grabbed a branch to steady myself. "Angel of God," I pleaded, "please protect us." Could God even hear my plea over the storm? Heaven had never seemed farther away. I stumbled after Wolfgang and the others. The trees seemed to be thinning. I stepped into a clearing. Though the rain was falling so hard, it was difficult to see more than a few yards in front of me. "Look," Mark said, "I see a light. There must be a house." I saw it too. I could just barely make out the cottage. "Let's run for it," I said. I took Mark's hand, our feet dripping and sliding on the grass. What if no one's home? But just before Wolfgang reached it, the door swung open as if we were expected. An old man wearing the faded lumberjack of a woodcutter stood inside the doorway. "Grüß Gott," he greeted, as us, a gracious smile spreading across his face. He motioned us to a fire that filled every corner of the room with a golden glow. There he handed each of us a blanket and helped us spread our soggy clothes on the hearth. The fire's radiance and the old man's kindness made the room more than warm and cozy. The Austrians have a word for it, Gemütlich, and that's exactly what the cottage felt like. It's in a heavenly sort of way. I soaked up the warmth of the blaze, barely noticing that our host had stepped away. He returned carrying a tray with a plate of cookies and mugs of piping hot chocolate topped with puffs of whipped cream. "This will make you feel better," he said. "Mmm," said the kids, licking the cream from their lips. It was delicious, but puzzling. Would he have made it all this for himself, or was he expecting company? "Thank you," Wolfgang said. "I don't know how much farther we could have made it. I feel bad. I should have been watching the weather more closely." "No need to explain," the old woodcutter said. "I know exactly what happened. You were having fun." His voice was gentle and soothing, almost like music. The stress of the storm had melted away. I felt completely at ease, as if we were spending the afternoon with a dear friend. We barely noticed that the rain had ended and the thunder had wandered off, grumbling to itself. I looked out the window. The late afternoon sun shone brightly through the curtains. "Tante Helga, she'd be worried about us if we were late." "Your clothes are dry," our host said, as if he'd read my mind. "You'll be fine going down. Just follow the path to the bridge, then turn left, and it will take you to the road that goes right past your aunt's house." "Perfect." We said our goodbyes and set off down the trail. It wasn't until we reached the bridge that I wondered, how had he known where we were staying? "Tante Helga knows everyone around here," I reminded myself. "She must have told him about us." I turned around for one last wave, but saw no one. No house, not even the clearing. "The trees are probably blocking my view," I thought, but I hadn't even noticed that we were back in the forest. We found the road, and soon we were back at Tante Helga's, just like the woodcutter had said. "You're totally dry," she said. "How did you miss the storm?" We told her about the house in the woods. Her face grew more puzzled with every word. "I know the cottage you're talking about," she said, "but it burned down 50 years ago. Tante Helga shook her head. But the old woodcutter," Sandy said, "would he be a ghost?" Tante Helga shook her head. "Nein," she said, "not a ghost, an angel sent to watch over you." I thought of the prayer I'd said, lost in the crashing of the thunder. God had heard every word. He had given us shelter even in the midst of the storm. My favorite one, let's see, that I want to share with you, is called Christmas Angel of Hope. This just really struck me. I have a quote here from the Review and Herald, April 19, 1870. Angels of God that excel in strength are sent to minister to those who shall be heirs of salvation. These angels, when they see that we are doing the very utmost on our part to be overcomers, will do their part, and their light will shine around about us and sway back the influence of the evil angels that are around us, and will make a fortification around us as a wall of fire. The story of hope was an integral part of Phyllis Scott's Christmas memories, and she would forever be touched when she shared it. Back in 1911, when she was four and her brother, two, their parents, Jack and Martha, often struggled financially. Still, they shared an especially close bond, and there was always enough food and love to go around. That Christmas week was a troublesome one for the Scott family because Phyllis's little brother, Tommy, was sick. He had a high temperature, and the doctor feared that he might have polio. In those days, there was no vaccines for polio, and many children died from that disease. Throughout the days and nights that preceded Christmas, Jack and Martha took turns kneeling by their sick little boy's bed and praying for his recovery. In addition to the child's illness, there were other troubles that Christmas. The mill where Jack worked had cut his hours in recent weeks, and they had been unable to afford Christmas presents for their children. Martha had been secretly knitting socks and scarves, but her dream of buying a toy for Phyllis and Tommy and some candy had been shattered. Now it was all they could do to purchase food and other necessities. The Scots spent Christmas Eve gathered in Tommy's bedroom, praying and singing carols and sponging the boy's feverish body. After a long and restless night, the Scots finally fell exhausted into their own beds. Very early on Christmas morning, when Martha was up fixing breakfast and arranging to wrap parcels of socks and scarves by the children's plates, she heard a loud knocking on the door. Martha tilted her head curiously and wiped her hands on her apron as she moved toward the front door. "Yes," she said as she opened it. There on the front porch was a handsome, well-dressed man and a pretty little girl. A large white dog stood at the child's side. "Merry Christmas, Mrs. Scott," the stranger said in a soft voice filled with kindness. "I've come to see how Tommy is doing." Martha stood staring at the man and child on her porch, unable to comprehend how a stranger might know the name and her name and the name of her child. "Do I know you?" The man ignored the question. "How is the child, Mrs. Scott?" "Sir, who are you?" she asked. There was an unusual presence about the man, and she was afraid, but she wanted very much to know the identity of the stranger before her. The man shook his head politely and smiled. "I came only to find out the condition of your son, ma'am," he said. Still flustered, Martha ran her hand through her hair and took a deep breath and decided to answer the man. "Well, he's only a little boy, 2 years old," she began. The man nodded kindly, and the little girl beside him smiled. Martha continued, "He's always been in good health until about a week ago when he caught this fever," and she paused and her voice cracked. "Doctor says it might be polio." "I know," the man said softly, reaching out toward Martha and squeezing her hand, "but he will recover shortly." Tears began streaming down Martha's face, which she wiped away quickly. "Please, sir," she said, her face contorted in confusion. "Come in, out of the cold, and tell me who you are, how you know our names." Again the man smiled and shook his head. "We must be going now," he said. "Close the door quickly so the cold won't get into the boy's room. But wait." The man waved once, then he and the child and the big white dog turned around and walked down the porch steps. Although he had cautioned her to close the door, Martha stood on the porch watching the trio to see where they were headed. Just as they reached the last step, Jack called out from the back room, and Martha turned away. When she looked toward the porch again, the man, the little girl, and the dog had disappeared. Martha ran quickly down the porch steps and scanned the street in both directions. But the sidewalks were empty. Dazed by what had happened, she walked slowly back into the house and shared the story with her husband. Who could he have possibly been? She asked him. I don't know, Martha, Jack said. Then he smiled. Maybe he was sent by God. A Christmas present to assure us that little Tommy is going to be all right. The couple pondered this, and before waking the children, they prayed again for their sick son. I'm going to check on Tommy, Martha said as she stood up from the table. You get Phyllis, and I'll tell her to come downstairs for Christmas breakfast. A few minutes later, when Jack was in Phyllis's room waking the girl and wishing her a Merry Christmas, he heard Martha. Jack, come quickly, she shouted. Jack grabbed Phyllis's hand, and the two of them ran down the hallway toward Tommy's room. What is it? Jack was frightened. Perhaps Tommy had grown worse, or he might not have survived the night. When they entered the little boy's room, Jack saw Martha sitting on the bed, her eyes glistening with unshed tears. As Tommy sat grinning in her arms, she reached for her husband's hand. Jack, the fever's gone. He seems completely better, she whispered. Dear God, Jack whispered, and slowly he knelt on the floor beside the child's bed. The Scott family held hands and thanked God for healing Tommy. And thank you, too, God, for the stranger this morning. Thank you for giving us hope. They did not see or hear from the strange man again until 3 years later, in April 1914. This time he was alone. But when Martha answered the door, she knew instantly that this was the same man who had visited them that Christmas evening, or that Christmas morning. You've come again, Martha said, opening the door and waved an arm toward her living room. Please come in. I want to know your name. Who are you? But just as before, the man smiled and shook his head. I wanted to tell you I'm sorry about your husband losing his job, but he will be working again soon. This time, before Martha could say another word, the man smiled warmly, tipped his hat politely, and turned quickly to leave. Martha called after him and watched as he turned around the corner of the house and headed toward the thick woods in the back of their home. Martha ran down the steps after him, but by the time she got to the back of the house, there was no one in sight and not a sound from anywhere. Again, the man had disappeared. Shocked by his visitation, Martha returned to the house and convinced herself that she must have been imagining things. The man must have been a different person, and he must have had the wrong house. After all, Jack had not lost his job. She silently thanked God that her husband did, in fact, have a job and tried to forget about the stranger at the door. That night, Jack came home from work earlier than usual with his shoulders slumped in the feet. He pulled Martha slowly into a tight hug and then sat her down gently on the warm sofa. I have some bad news, he said, looking deeply into her eyes. I was laid off today. Martha felt her heart skip a beat at her husband's words. The stranger had been right after all. She sighed deeply and told Jack about the visit from the stranger earlier that day. He said you'd be back working again soon, she said as she finished the story. Jack, who is he? Jack shook his head in awe. Whoever he is, he seems to want to bring us hope. Remember that Christmas morning when we wondered if Tommy was going to make it? He already knew everything was going to be all right and wanted to give us the same peace of mind. Maybe it's true. Maybe we have nothing to worry about now either. Martha nodded. Well, let's go eat dinner. At least for now, we still have food on the table. She moved to take off her apron, then suddenly she gasped. Jack, she screamed, look! In her hand, she held a $20 bill, which had been nestled in her apron pocket. $20, Jack, where in the world did it come from? For a moment, Jack and Martha were silent, and then at the same time, both reached the same conclusion. The stranger? Martha asked quietly. Jack nodded and took her hand. Maybe he was more than a stranger, Martha. Maybe he was our guardian angel. It's possible, isn't it? For days, the couple pondered the stranger and his message. Then 2 weeks later, Jack's job was restored, and he was given a bonus check for returning to his position. After that, the Scots were convinced that whoever the man was, he was neither human nor ordinary. He had known their names and their needs, and he had brought them hope in times of despair. Each year until Martha died, her faith remained strong as she told the story of the stranger who came bearing hope. The Christmas angel, she liked to call him. In many ways, the stranger is still spreading hope today as the story, which now belongs to Phyllis, continues to be passed down among the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren of Jack and Martha Scott. I just thought it was really cool that the same angel came and visited them twice. And it just shows how much God really cares about us and that we do have angels around us and our guardian angels to help us through difficult situations, even though they seem impossible. I would like to close with, God will take care of you. Let's sing.
We would like to stand for our closing hymn.